cell.
I would then jump off his shoulders and crash through a waiting table that had been set up on the floor earlier in the contest. It was the only big stunt spot in the match, but I knew it would blow the roof off if done right because it had never been seen before. But once we got into the heat of the moment, fired up by the energy of the crowd and the surge of our adrenaline, we moved too fast and I wasn't properly balanced when I stood on his shoulders. We gingerly walked to the center of the room, but I didn't have my bearings when I let go of Sho's hand and tilted too far to one side, almost falling to the mat. I steadied myself by bending my knees, but then I wasn't even close to reaching the titles when I reached up to grab them. It was obvious there was no way I'd be able to take the titles off the hook, so we were kind of just standing there waiting for something to happen as the crowd got quiet. It came back to life when Sean entered and connected with a massive superkick to Sho's chin over 6 feet in the air, which was impressive enough on its own. The big man turned around on the cell but forgot to take the step toward the ropes that I needed to be on target for the table. Timing was everything, and I only had a second to decide how I was going to take the bump off his shoulders. It was the last fall of the night for me, and I figured, fuck it, I'm going for it, and launched myself as if the momentum from HBK's kick had thrown me off balance. The momentum my feet left the solid base of Sho's traps. I knew I was in trouble. I was too far away to clear the top rope, but I found myself already starting my descent. The only chance I had was to try to stand on the top rope, and to my surprise, I landed directly on that bitch, perched perfectly like a Persian parrot. "Polly want a fucking cracker?" I said to no one in particular, feeling prouder than Kelsey's nuts. Then gravity took over and I lost my balance for the second time, jumping in vain to try and hit my target. The rope wasn't stable enough to get a good push-off, and I hung in the air like Wile E. Coyote for what seemed like forever before plunging straight down. I had planned on landing in the middle of the table, but since I was plummeting toward the ground head first, I could see that wasn't in the cards. It seemed like I was going to miss the table completely, so I stretched out my arms, hoping to collide with some part of it, any part of it, and I did. With my face. I landed mouth first on the corner of the table, and I know this because I actually tasted it. It had a vaguely dirty flavor, like I had just licked a leaf. My hands bounced off the flat top, and my knees collapsed the second I landed, which made things look much worse. I'm not sure how I didn't break my leg, tear a pec, or recapture the coveted Lloyd Christmas look I had after I broke my teeth in the HBK ladder match, but I came out of it intact. It's funny that the four of us agreed to do the TLC only if there weren't any dangerous bumps, yet the fall I had just taken was easily one of the worst of my career. With me out of the picture and barely alive, HBK superkicked Sho for a second time, and Hunter knocked him over the top rope with the mangled ladder. Then Triple H held up the one-sided piece of hardware so Sean could climb to the top, unhook the titles, and make DX the tag team champions for the first time ever. Meanwhile, I was lying on the floor trying to get the taste of lemon pledge out of my mouth. Chapter 25. Mean Mr. Mustard. Shortly after the PPV, we left for a European tour with DX versus Jericho and Sho headlining most nights. The tour consisted of a grueling 12 shows in 12 nights, airport, hotel, arena, airport grind, which made it quite easy to burn out. The best way to avoid that was to break out of the routine and do some different things, so I decided to go check out Abbey Road, the site of one of the most iconic album covers of all time. Our first show was in London, so referee Marty Elias and I navigated the intricate tube system and met my old high school chum Wallace, who'd moved to the UK from Canada years earlier. Wallace and I had discovered the WWE together and formed our own wrestling league, the BTWF, Big Time Wrestling Federation, along with our own techno-metal band, the BTWF Orchestra. We were also huge Beatles freaks, so walking across Abbey Road was on both of our bucket lists. Now, when you see the famous photo of the Beatles walking across the intersection, the streets look so big, but in reality it's really quite small and stretches maybe 20 feet across. I was surprised that the crosswalk was in the middle of a busy intersection, with cars flying by rapidly every few seconds. The regular commuters who had to drive through it every day were probably sick and tired of the goofy tourists trying to stroll across while having their pictures taken. I bet they would have had no problem playing a little Death Race 2000 if they knew they could have gotten away with it. There were a ton of gawkers congregating on both sides of the street, waiting patiently for their precious few seconds, and it was funny to see how they marched across when they finally got their turn. The Beatles weren't posing when the cover was shot. They were merely walking across the road with their arms swinging naturally. But these people were trying to reenact exactly how it looked on the cover, arms jutting stiffly from their sides and knees locked out, like nerdy tin soldiers wearing khaki shorts with fanny packs. Wallace and I showed up dressed appropriately. He in an all-black Sprockets ensemble, complete with black beret, me in an open-throated McCartney-esque suit. Marty stationed himself on a corner of the intersection and waited until the traffic cleared. When it was our turn, I took off my shoes and socks for the pace de resistance and marched across the most famous road in rock and roll history. Those 3 seconds were some of the fruitest of my life. Abbey Road was my favorite Beatles record and cover. I love it so much I got it tattooed on my left arm. Ask me next time we meet and I'll show it to you. And here I was experiencing something most superfans never would. I stood in the middle of the street and drank in the special moment until a Fiat comes scorching toward me, and I had to take my leave. "Hey, Jericho!" I heard the driver yell as he drove by. I was such a worldwide superstar. I'd been recognized on the Beatles' own street. "I'm gonna be famous, a star on the screen," I hummed to myself as I hopped up on the curb and stepped into a pile of fresh dog shit with my bare feet. Happiness is some warm dung. Bang, bang, poop, poop. I continued my magical mystery tour a few days later before our show at the Echo Arena in Liverpool, when Marty and I visited a tourist attraction called the Beatles Experience. It boasted such gems as the original Sergeant Pepper uniforms and the reassembled remnants of the actual Cavern Club. There was so much history there that I was shocked when Marty told me it was already 6 p.m. I was in the main event that night. There it is again, so I wasn't late. But the doors had already opened and I had to walk across to the arena in plain sight of the thousands of wrestling fans who were now roaming the grounds. With no security, this could have turned into a real mob scene. Or even worse, Victoria, British Columbia, Part 2, Electric Boogaloo. I needed a plan. I told Marty to beeline it to the arena and not slow down no matter what. I would follow behind him with my head down, staring at his feet to guide me the whole way. We left the safety of the Beatles Experience into the walking live like Rick and Glenn, but without the benefit of zombie entrails hanging around our necks to camouflage ourselves. I stared down at Marty's sneakers as he led the way and as a result saw all types of shoes out of my peripheral vision. Cowboy boots, Doc Martens, loafers, dress shoes, high heels, wooden clogs. WTF? If the WWE ever needs to do a survey on what kind of footwear their fan base wears, I'm bowdy bowdy and rowdy rowdy. It was funny how many hundreds of people were walking past me with no idea that the guy they'd be booing the shit out of only a few hours later was right in their midst. With all the concerts I'd been to over the years, I wondered if I'd ever walked past Bruce Dickinson or Mick Jagger in the parking lot before a show. It reminded me of the time I cruised past a kid wearing a Y2J shirt outside of the arena in Memphis and yelled, "Nice shirt, dude!" The kid barely glanced up and missed his chance forever. Too bad, Junior. Our luck held as we weaved through the oblivious crowd and made it to the side door of the arena. Marty went inside as I lingered behind, reveling in the fact that I'd hidden in plain sight and fooled everyone. "Sorry, suckers," I mumbled and strolled like a boss through the sanctuary of the backstage door, ready to... "Can I see your pass?" a security guard asked with arms crossed. Pass? I vaguely remembered getting some sort of laminate on the first day of the tour, but hadn't seen it since. After assuring the guard, who looked old enough to have worked for the actual Beatles, that I didn't need a pass, I attempted to walk inside for a second time.
"No pass, no entrance into the backstage. You'll have to go around front," the guard said wearily, his face stonier than a beef-eater palace guard.
I'd come so close to safe passage and didn't have time to argue with Rip Van Wanker, especially since there was a small crowd starting to congregate around the door.
"But I'm Chris Jericho, and I'm in the main event tonight, so I need to get in."
"No pass, no entrance."
The small crowd had grown and their ears perked up at the mention of my name. I was running out of time.
"Listen, man. Do you see that poster on the wall behind you?"
I pointed at a large event placard with my face plastered on it. "That's my face, you dig? Do I look like I shouldn't be back here? I don't even have an English accent."
"Hey, is that Chris Jericho?"
a fan said excitedly. Uh-oh.
"No pass, no entrance."
"That is Jericho,"
another bloke shouted, and the chase was on. I gave mean Mr. Mustard the stink eye, and Power walked away with a group of fans now in tow. The unwanted entourage, great song title, grew larger, and it was time to bail. So I broke into an all-out sprint. The crowd quickened their pace, and suddenly I was having my own Beatle experience as I ran around the side of the arena with a gang of screaming chicks, a.k.a. giggling guys, following closely behind me. I had no idea where I was going or how I would escape, but when I saw another side door, I threw it open and barreled inside. "Don't ask me for a pass," I yelled at the pimple-faced security guard sitting in the hallway.
"You're Chris Jericho, mate," he said excitedly. "You don't need a bloody pass."
Another day in the life of Y2J. Chapter 26. Humbled. After the show in Liverpool, we took a charter to Paris, and I was drinking Crown Royal, which is pure fire water for me. It was the only thing I drank at the time, although I have no idea why, as the wicked elixir turned me crazy and the nights never ended well. That's why Drunkico was in full force when we arrived at our hotel at 6 a.m. There was always food awaiting us when we checked into our overseas hotels, and everybody went to grab a bite before crashing out. Most of the crew was sitting at the various tables eating quietly, except me. I was swearing up a storm. Everything was fuck this and fuck that until finally Hurricane Helms pointed out that HBK was sitting at the next table with his family. He'd brought them on the tour for a working vacation, and to his credit, he didn't expect us to act any differently around them. Sean, of all people, knew that boys will be boys on the road and didn't expect any of us not to party. However, Drunkico was an obnoxious buffoon and didn't care about shielding the children's young ears from profanity. Hurricane warned me I was swearing too much and that I should think about toning it down a little. "I'm not swearing that much. Besides, he shouldn't have his kids out this late anyway," I bleated belligerently. Hurricane told me to keep my voice down, and I said defensively, "I wasn't talking loudly." But I was wrong, for Sean and his family got up and left their table. I hoped I hadn't insulted them and yelled out, "See you tomorrow, man." He walked out the door without saying anything, but 10 seconds later he stormed back into the room, his eyes ablaze. "You shut your damn mouth," he warned me. "Yeah, my family is up late, and if you got a problem with that, go to hell." He let his words hang in the air as he glared at me and left the room. "Sean, wait!" I yelled after him. "You're my hero!" I pleaded as if that was going to make a difference. I turned back to a dozen silent faces, feeling like the motherfucker of the year, and wondered what I'd done to make Sean so angry. Sure, I had cursed in front of his kids, but what was the big deal?
"It wasn't that you swore," Hurricane explained. "He's mad because you said he shouldn't have his kids here."
"I didn't say it that loudly," I protested.
Yeah, you did. You're too drunk to notice."
I got up from the table totally ashamed of myself and staggered guiltily back up to my room. I wrote Sean a long, detailed text explaining how awful I felt and how embarrassed I was about what I'd said, hoping he'd still be awake. He didn't return it, so I figured he'd fallen asleep and would get back to me in the morning. I slept most of the day away, and when I woke up, had the worst feeling in the pit of my stomach. I vaguely remembered what had happened, so I grabbed my phone to see if Sean had texted me back. When he hadn't, I knew we had a serious problem. I paced around my room trying to figure out how I was going to smooth things over. Obviously, I had to apologize, but how was he going to take it? I wanted to call his room, but I knew he was with his family, and I thought it was smarter to speak to him in person. I spent the rest of the day worrying so badly that I thought I was going to give myself an ulcer. Finally, the moment of truth arrived. It was time to go to the venue. Heels and baby faces traveled on separate buses during overseas tours, so I had no contact with Sean as I rode to the arena in silence. I was still too embarrassed and ashamed to talk to anybody else, and besides, this was between the two of us. The heel bus arrived first, and when I stepped off, it was darkly cold outside, which matched the way I felt inside. I stood at the entrance waiting for Sean to arrive, and when he walked in, I asked if I could have a word.
"In a few minutes," he said curtly and walked into catering.
I was too wound up to eat, so I waited anxiously in the corridor for half an hour waiting for him to finish. Finally, he left the hall and went up the stairs to the dressing room. I waited a few seconds and followed his lead. After knocking on the door, I summoned up the last of my courage and walked in. He was sitting by himself and told me to close the door.
"I don't really have much to say to you, but let me be clear about something. All I care about is my family, and I don't give a damn about you or what you think about them being here with me."
I hung my head like a whipped dog and tried to stammer out a stilted apology, reiterating what I'd texted him earlier.
"I don't care about your apology," Sean cut me off bluntly. "Now, you listen to me. I've stood up for you so many times when people said you were a pain in the ass, but never again. You think you're untouchable, but you're not. This best-in-the-world shit is going to your head, and you need to get yourself straight."
Each word broke away another little piece of my heart as my childhood hero, mentor, and all-time favorite opponent explained to me how much of a jerk-off I had been. It was hard to listen to him talking to me this way, even though I totally deserved it. And he was only getting started.
"You need to start acting like a top guy if you're ever going to be one. Staying up all night drinking and being an asshole, you're losing everyone's respect."
I expected him to tell me next that fat, drunk, and stupid was no way to go through life, but this was no joke, and I was humbled because I knew he was right. There's a certain level of responsibility in being a top-level performer, and a certain line you can't cross if you want to be taken seriously as a locker room leader. You've got to be an inspiration, not an embarrassment. You would never see The Undertaker drunk as hell and swearing in front of children at 6 in the morning. On top of that, Sean was right. I had created a monster with this new character, and it had spiraled out of control. Sometimes I dropped into it so deeply that it was hard to let it go. The theory that Heath Ledger overdosed on sleeping pills because he could no longer sleep due to the dark depths he traveled to in order to portray the Joker in The Dark Knight made perfect sense to me. My commitment to the craft had warped me, causing problems in my life all across the board, and even though I knew it was happening, to hear it from my most respected peer made it hit home even harder.
"You're totally right, Sean. I need to change things up. Can you help me?"
I knew Sean had experienced similar problems in the mid-90s when he had the reputation as the hardest person in the business to deal with. Sean slowly shook his head.
"You're on your own with this one, Chris."
Wow, that hurt. But he was right, and the irony was that Sean and I were very similar in a lot of ways. We both came into the business branded as little guys, which gave us huge chips on our shoulders and caused us to have to work extra hard to get noticed. We were both opinionated and deemed hard to deal with as a result, but made it to the top of our crafts for that very reason. We both had egos in the stratosphere at times, but this time, Sean pulled me down to earth faster than a skydiver without a parachute. He was done talking, so I apologized again and left him alone. I didn't feel that he'd forgiven me, but later when we went over our match, he was a little friendlier, and that gave me a small modicum of relief. Then I sought out his wife, Rebecca, and apologized, as I'm sure my behavior had insulted her as well. She accepted my apology and said what pissed them off the most about my behavior was me obnoxiously saying goodnight to Sean as they were leaving.
"We felt it was a real Eddie Haskell two-faced thing to do, like you were mocking him and challenging him to do something about it if he didn't like it."
That hadn't been my intention at all, but I understood what I said could have been taken that way. When I got back to my room, I thought about everything that had gone down over the past 24 hours and decided I'd make some changes. No more all-night Crown Royal drinking sessions while on tour, because I had responsibilities to live up to as a locker room veteran. More importantly, whether I was drinking or not, I needed to tone down the attitude I'd developed as a person, essentially learn how to separate church and state and leave the Jericho heel character where it belonged, in the ring. I'd have to make these changes on my own, as HBK said. But I was up for the challenge. Sean's words gave me a real wake-up call, and I'm thankful he said them. Vince told me years earlier that he wanted to teach me life lessons along with wrestling lessons, and he has. That night, Sean taught me a major life lesson of his own that humiliated and humbled me. And I'll always appreciate that. After that, we became closer than ever, and I still consider HBK to be one of my best friends in the business. Thanks, Sean. Chapter 27. Effeminate Tough Guy. When Big Show and I lost the tag team titles to DX in December 2009, I wasn't supposed to be allowed on Raw any longer. But then Mike Tyson was booked for the show in mid-January 2010, and since Vince wanted my final Monday Night blow-off angle to be with him, we needed to think of a way to get me reinstated. What he came up with was one of the most bizarre angles of my career. At the final Raw before Christmas 2009, guest host Johnny Damon was going to grant Show one wish from Santa Claus. He would then confront Santa in the ring and ask that his tag team partner and best friend Chris Jericho be allowed back on the program. Santa would of course say yes, but then that dastardly Hornswoggle would run in the ring and rip off Santa's beard, revealing that jolly old Saint Nick was actually me. To make things even more preposterous, after I was unmasked like Shandy, Show and I would be attacked by a gang of midgets. It's as ridiculous as it sounds, but as Loverboy once said, we better start from the start. The big storyline of the night was Hornswoggle taking DX to Little People's Court for their constant mistreatment. Sean and Hunter would crawl under the ring where Swoggle lived, end up in another dimension, and embark on a wacky Alice in Wonderland-esque journey to find him. It was as rotten as it sounds, and you would have to be on opium to find any of it entertaining. They would eventually find the Little People's Courtroom populated with a dozen dwarves who would put them on trial and find DX guilty. It was completely hokey, the kind of thing you would only see in the WWE. Then after all that horse shit, Sho and I would treat all the munchkins to a massive beatdown. When the ragtag collection of minikins showed up for rehearsal, it was amazing to see how small they really were. Vince even told a couple of them to go home because he was afraid they might get hurt in the melee. The idea was they would surround us in a semicircle and attack, but Sho and I would eliminate every last one of them until DX came to chase us away. The thing had the potential to stink out the joint, and when we were finished going over everything, Vince looked at me and said, "My dad will be rolling in his grave after this." I responded, "Who can blame him? Besides, it's your fault. You booked this shit." I put on the Santa outfit, complete with fat suit, granny glasses, bushy white eyebrows, and gaudy circles of rouge on my face that made my cheeks look like roses, my nose like a cherry. But it was quite convincing, and nobody recognized me. I got the final approval from Vince, who gave me the thumbs up, but told me, "Make sure to change that prissy walk of yours. Everyone will know it's you if you don't." Vince always mocks my sliding gait at every opportunity, and once told me, "You're the most effeminate tough guy I've ever met." He also hated when I went through my scarf phase. That's why Alberto Del Rio wears them to the ring as a heel, and abhors it when I sit with my legs crossed. Macho, Macho McMahon. So I practiced walking like I had candy cane up my ass and spoke with a weird accent that was half Mrs. Doubtfire, half Stewie from Family Guy. I had to come up with something. I wasn't about to be outdone by fresh ground pepper Santa now, was I? The segment began with Show in the ring summoning Santa to hear his wish, and out he came with a rockin' version of Jingle Bells as his entrance music and a Bella twin on each arm. It was ricoculous to see Santa Claus written in huge letters on the Titantron with accompanying falling snowflakes, like he was coming out to challenge Stone Cold Steve Austin for the world title. I strolled down the aisle doing everything I could not to walk like an effeminate tough guy, waving to the crowd like I was the Pope and bellowing, "Ho, ho, ho," like a mo-fo-fo. Santa commented that Show was the biggest boy he'd ever seen, and it was probably a smart idea for Santa to sit on his lap instead. He asked Show if he'd been a good boy in his Stewie and Doubtfire drawl, and he replied with a resounding, "Yes, Santa," in an over-the-top, innocent voice. Then he told Santa that his only Christmas wish was for his best friend Chris Jericho to be reinstated on Raw. Santa pondered the request thoughtfully, and finally granted his request, which of course the crowd hated. I couldn't believe they were actually buying this shit. Sho and Santa celebrated until Hornswoggle jumped into the ring and pulled off Santa's beard. Santa stared at Swoggle in a not-so-jolly way and chased him out of the ring. The crowd finally got it and gasped in recognition as I ripped off the rest of my disguise and revealed myself.
"That's Chris Jericho," said announcer Michael Cole with shock.
Then it was our turn to be shocked as Hornswoggle and his dirty half-dozen, get it, emerged from under the ring and hopped into position. I can only imagine how uncomfortable Sho felt as he had a phobia of little people, like the elephant and the mouse. But he held his cool and the standoff began. I told the tiny terrors before the show to wait until I gave the cue before bum-rushing us, because, as always, I wanted the crowd at its peak before the fight began. But the fans weren't too sure what to make of the preposterous scenario and were almost silent, so I decided it was time to get it on and get it over with. I gave the cue, they charged, and I threw them off one by one like I was Gulliver, until there was only one little guy hanging onto my leg for dear life as I dragged him along the mat. This was even more ridiculous, considering I was wearing only Santa trousers, suspenders, big black boots, rosy cheeks, and a rummy's nose. Sho pulled the little guy off my leg and gave him a crushing side slam that shook him up so badly he had to go to the hospital for real. Then, adding insult to injury, the giant destroyer picked him up by the legs like a Thanksgiving turkey and tossed him nonchalantly over the top rope. I thought we would get major heat for beating up a gang of little people, but we were getting more of the what-the-hell-are-we-watching reaction, until I trapped Hornswoggle and pushed him into Sho's massive mitt for a chokeslam. The crowd finally woke up and screamed at us to please stop, until the DX saviors ran down and chased us away. It was a ludicrous end to the show, and when I walked through Gorilla, I asked Vince if his dad was still rolling in his grave.
He's doing a full-on gymnastics routine at this point.
A few weeks after Tyson's DX betrayal finally got me kicked off Raw, Sho and I broke up forever. It happened after I was staging a full-on demonstration outside the arena in Hartford, protesting my unfair treatment by the WWE by marching back and forth with a placard that read, "Stop the Jericho Embargo." I'm not sure what that means, but it still makes me laugh. I set up a petition that I wanted the gathering crowd to sign, expressing their desire to see me back on Raw. I figured nobody would participate, as they would be happy to see Jericho finally get his comeuppance. But the opposite happened, and the fans were signing it as quickly as they could. After a few attempts to find legit Jericho haters in the crowd, we gave up and added a few plants to insult me instead. Finally, Sho came outside to tell me he wouldn't be helping me with my quest to get back on Raw because we were through. We thought it would be funny to do the scene like we were breaking up for real in some sort of a cliched romantic comedy starring Vince Vaughn and Jennifer Aniston, and play it totally straight.
"I'm doing this for us, Sho," I pleaded. "We deserve a rematch against DX, and I just can't let it go. I don't want this to end."
"Let it go, Chris. It's over," Sho replied tenderly.
"Don't say that, Sho. I stay awake at night thinking about us. What we had was special, and you can't deny that."
"It was special, Chris. Nobody knows me like you did. But it's time to move on. I'm on Raw. You're on SmackDown. Long-distance relationships don't work, Chris. It's over."
"Is there someone else?"
Sho shook his head.
"No. But I'm moving on. Just know I care about you."
"I'm always going to cherish the memories, Sho,"
I yelled in desperation as he walked away and out of my life forever. I ate a carton of Haagen-Dazs and cried myself to sleep that night. Chapter 28. The Little People of America. I was in the locker room in Nashville reading an article in Guitar World about Lynyrd Skynyrd, whose guitarists Gary Rossington, Ricky Medlock, and Mark Mateschka were on the cover. R-Truth came in and we started talking about the different music we'd listened to in high school and the difference between growing up in Canada and in the Deep South. The conversation turned to how there were more midgets in my high school, 2, than black kids, 1. He'd read my uber-popular how-to manual, A Lion's Tale. Have you? And asked whatever happened to my diminutive pals. I mentioned that one of them, Tanya Davis, had become a stand-up comedian and a favorite of the Maury Povich show, but I hadn't seen her in almost 20 years. We had our match, and after the show, Doc Amon asked me if I wanted to meet him out for a drink, since his girlfriend lived in town and knew a good spot across the street from the arena. I was still in my ring gear, even though I'd finished my match hours earlier, and told him I'd catch up with him later. I'm really lazy when it comes to taking off my stuff, and I wish there was a pill I could take that would make the sweaty spandex slide off on its own, or that I had a young Japanese boy to take off my stuff and then wash my back in the shower. That's my definition of making it, fearless readers. But alas, since we weren't in Japan, I had to take off my own gear and wash my own back. Hashtag wrestler problems. But just because I didn't have someone to soap me down and help me feel fresh, that didn't mean Zack Ryder had to go without. He was wandering around the locker room looking for someone to nair his back, so I stepped in, spread the luxurious lather on his lats, and shaved away. A few minutes later, his unwanted hairs were history. So I put on my short shorts and disappeared into the night. I decided to drop by to see Doc for one drink, but no more, as I had a 4-hour drive to Atlanta for SmackDown, and wanted to have a quiet night. I saw the bar across the street and stopped at an intersection next to a guy who looked vaguely familiar. I was pretty sure I hadn't met him before, but after a few seconds, it hit me. He was one of the guitar players from Lynyrd Skynyrd who was on the cover of the Guitar World magazine I'd been reading earlier. "Excuse me, aren't you in Lynyrd Skynyrd?" I said, paraphrasing the question I'd been asked 1,000 times. Mark Matechka smiled and confirmed that he was. I told him I'd just been reading about him, and we started talking. Turned out Skynyrd had a few days off, and he had nothing going on that evening, so I asked him if he wanted to hang with me. The Skynyrd guys are long-time wrestling fans, and I'm a long-time Skynyrd fan. So we had a lot in common right off the bat. When we got inside the saloon, I was telling him one of my favorite memories of me, Dean, Chavo Jr., Eddie, and Benoit going to see them in Sturgis the night before a WCW PPV many years earlier. Meanwhile, the singer from the saloon's band recognized Mark and invited him on stage to jam. He set in on a few blues tunes and then did Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. More on this evil song later. Then Mark motioned me over like he was David St. Hubbins and I was Nigel Tufnell, and a few seconds later I was singing Journey's biggest song with a guitar player from Skynyrd. The heads of classic rock DJs all over the country exploded. When the tune ended, we got more Freebird chants than Michael Hayes, but my work was done, and I left the stage. I ordered a drink and noticed another one of the signs on the wall that I'd been seeing around town all day. Nashville welcomes the National Convention of the Little People of America. Quite the coincidence, since I'd been talking to R-Truth earlier about the Little People of Canada. As if on cue, I felt a tug on my leg and looked down into the face of Tanya Davis, who I hadn't seen since Westwood Collegiate in 1988 and who I'd just been talking about hours earlier. What the hell was up with this day? I wished Paul McCartney had been on the cover of Guitar World, and that I'd been talking about Roxanne Falk, the hottest girl in my high school, instead. I gave Tanya a hug, and after catching up on our families and successes, she said, "You have to come meet my friends." She introduced me to another ragtag group of little people who, I hoped, weren't avid watchers of Raw and seeking revenge on Big Show and me. Thankfully, they didn't want vengeance, just alcohol, and ordered a tray of shots. At this point, I gave up on my plans for a quiet night, got down on my knees, and downed a lemon drop. These people might have been small, but their drinking abilities were big, and it wasn't long before I was on my knees with my new friends, including Mark, linked arm in arm, singing a reprise of Don't Stop Believin'. There's that evil song again. Until 5 a.m. as the janitors mopped the floor around us. Quiet night, indeed. Chapter 29. Glorified Rental Car Shuttle. We were in the midst of another European tour and had just finished a show in Zurich in front of one of the worst crowds I'd ever experienced. They had been silent for the entire night, seemingly with zero interest in the matches they'd paid to see. In my mind, they were all members of the cast of Sprockets, wearing black bodysuits with berets on their heads, similar to Wallace's Abbey Road ensemble, commenting in an accented, sardonic tone,
"What is with all the slamming and the jumping? If you just want to see the dancing!"
It was so bad that in the middle of my three-way match with Edge and Jack Swagger, I grabbed the mic and asked, "Are you people even alive? Should we just start dancing?" There was still no reaction, so we did the finish and got the hell out. At least my analogy got a big pop backstage, especially from Kane, who came back from his match still laughing while imagining 5,000 dieters in the crowd doing the salmon-spawning dance. When the show ended, we were told that there was a change in plans for the rest of the tour. Originally, we were scheduled to take the bus to Innsbruck, Austria for a show and then fly to a sold-out event in Istanbul that was going to gross over $1 million. But there had been a massive volcano eruption in Iceland that had blown so much ash into the air, flying was now impossible. This was a potential disaster for the WWE, as with the SmackDown crew in Europe and the Raw crew in Ireland, there wasn't enough talent stateside to do Monday's show from New Jersey. Since the Raw guys were stuck on the island of Ireland, they couldn't drive to a different airspace and were virtually trapped until the planes could take off. The last airport in all of Europe where planes were still flying out was in Madrid, and since we were in mainland Europe, it was decided that the SmackDown crew would drive the 1,662 kilometers, 1,033 miles for the metrically challenged, to Spain and fly to New Jersey from there to do Raw. Our last two shows were canceled because we had to leave immediately to make it to Madrid by 10:45 p.m. the next evening, the absolute latest we could take off to beat the oncoming volcanic ash cloud. I was choked that we had to leave because I had planned a snowboarding trip in Innsbruck for the day with John Morrison, but my hopes to ski the Alps were dashed. So I was already in a pissy mood when I boarded the bus at 11 p.m. and prepared for the 18-hour drive, but at least I was traveling on a luxury liner with plenty to eat and movies to watch. There were far worse ways to travel, I thought to myself as I reclined my overstuffed comfy chair and drifted off to sleep. I felt the bus grind to a halt and opened my eyes to find that we'd only been driving for 3 hours and were barely in Geneva. Due to the abrupt change in plans, our current bus couldn't leave Switzerland, so we had to switch to a new bus that would take us the rest of the way to Madrid. Standing on the street, I noticed our new bus was a fair bit smaller than the old one and realized there was no way everyone was going to fit. I called John Laurinaitis to tell him this wasn't going to work, especially considering we were going to be on the road for another 15 hours.
"It was our only option, Chris. Because of the volcano, everything else was booked up. We tried to get a helicopter, limousines, even rental cars, but everything was taken and all we could get was that bus in Geneva."
I reiterated that the new bus was simply too small and there was no way everybody was going to fit. Johnny said to squeeze in as many as we could and mentioned we had hotel rooms waiting for us to relax in once we arrived in Madrid. "Sounds great, but we have to make it to Madrid first," I said and hung up the phone. Kane overheard me talking to Johnny and asked what was going on. "I told John there's no way we can fit on this bus," I said, nodding at the medium-sized coach. Kane looked at me quizzically and said,
"That's not our new bus. That's our new bus."
He was pointing at what was essentially a glorified rental car shuttle that would have been hard-pressed to be classified as small if the other two buses were medium and large. We'd gone from a luxury bus to a passenger bus to a fucking clown car, from king status to geek status to no status. There was definitely no way that everybody could fit into this thing, and it was decided that only those who were deemed essential to Raw were allowed to board. It was like a WWE version of the Titanic lifeboats, only instead of women and children, it was top guys and mid-carders first. We were split up between the glorified rental car shuttle and another tiny van that had been drummed up to fit some of the overflow passengers. But all of the roadies and backstage crew members were left behind, along with a tag team called the Dude Busters, who, as far as I know, were never seen again. Last I heard, they had started their own cult in the mountains of Switzerland and had become gods. The glorified rental car shuttle, GRCS, looked even worse on the inside than it did on the outside. There was no bathroom, no food or drinks, and the seats were like those on a school bus, cramped and thinly padded with a straight-up seat back that didn't recline. There was no way I was going to be able to handle this for the next 15 hours. so I texted Vince to tell him that the GRCS wasn't good enough for the WWE crew. There wasn't even anything to eat.
"Guess you're gonna be hungry then, pal. Deal with it," was his reply.
I flipped out and texted him the 7 words that can never be printed in a book, and let's just leave it at that. We were on our own now, so we jammed all of our bags in the back of the bus and squeezed into our seats. I sat in the first row with my shins jabbed into the steel railing in front of me. The seat was so uncomfortable that I felt I was trapped in an Iron Maiden. Bogus, and I'm only 5'11". I couldn't even imagine how bad it was for the really tall guys like Kane, Harry Smith, or Edge, who was already on the phone with Johnny asking for his release. "I've had enough. This bus is terrible. I quit." I wasn't ready to go that far, but I was close. If I was going to have to endure this for 15 hours, it was time to enter Sandman. So I put my feet up on the case of dark beer I'd grabbed from our beautiful first bus. I hate dark beer, but that's all there was. Took half an Ambien and drifted off. I woke up with a new day's dawn breaking through the clouds as we approached the majestic mountains. A clock on my phone said 7 a.m. and an oncoming road sign said Madrid, 1,045 kilometers. That wasn't good. We'd been driving for 4 hours and had only gone about 350 kilometers, which meant we still had 1,000 kilometers to go. Turns out the GRCS wasn't much of a speed demon and was going a steady 40 clicks an hour as we crawled up the inclined highway into the mountains. I looked around the bus and saw different stages of uncomfortability. Edge was pretzeled in his chair a few rows behind me with his knees to his chin. Harry Smith was rocking back and forth in a fetal position and squishing Natty Neidhart into the sidewall, while Kane was stretched out on the floor of the bus, and Matt Hardy was dozing with his mouth pressed against the window next to R-Truth, who was the only other person awake besides me. As the GRCS navigated its way through the windy roads of the Alps, cutting through France on its way to Spain, I noticed it was steadily slowing down. The engine was straining to get up the mountain, its transmission shuddering and hiccuping with every shift of the clutch, causing the entire chassis of the vehicle to shake. The two bus drivers began chattering incessantly in French as faint plumes of smoke emanated from under the hood. The spare driver looked concerned as he opened the glove box and took out what I assumed was an owner's manual. He spoke in panicked French with the driver as the two of them tried to figure out what was causing the engine to overheat. I leaned forward and asked what the problem was, but the spare driver turned to me with wild eyes and said, "No English." I wished I had paid more attention to my high school French teacher, Mr. Tonnelier, and less to Roxanne Falk's ass. The two of them continued babbling to each other and then got on the phone with the AAA, or I suppose the FAA in this case, as the temperature inside the GRCS creeped up to uncomfortable levels. The spare driver hung up the cell and closed the book in a huff, obviously flustered at the lack of answers he'd received. Then he looked at the sky, mumbling, and somberly crossed himself like a Catholic priest. Truth and I looked at each other with wide eyes.
"Did you see that?"
"Yeah, the brother just crossed himself."
We turned back just as the guy reached into the glove box and took out a clear plastic bottle filled with brown liquid. He took a long pull, then passed it to the other driver, who took an even longer one. By the grimace on both of their faces, I can tell you that the brown liquid wasn't Lipton iced tea, kids. We hit each other with another double take, wondering how bad things could be that the drivers were crossing themselves and pounding straight whiskey while at the wheel. Was the GRCS going to break down in the middle of the French Alps, leaving us stranded and forcing us to become cannibals like the Donner Party? Would I have to munch on Mysterio's calf like a drumstick, only to have Kane cane me over the head and eat my rump roast? In the midst of the uncertainty, Truth and I did the only thing we could do, cracked open the lukewarm dark beer and took a drink of our own. It went down pretty harshly at first, but about an hour later that beer was tasting pretty fucking good, and we were feeling a lot better about our fate, even if the GRCS didn't agree. The good news was it hadn't slowed down any, but it was still only going somewhere between 30 and 40 kilometers an hour. Angry drivers were zipping past us like we were Lloyd and Harry headed to Aspen, except at least Lloyd and Harry got to pee. We'd been driving for almost 12 hours, and the dark beer was swishing around in our stomachs like water in a pail. It was a welcome sight when we finally saw a rest stop on the side of the road, for two reasons. One, we were out of the Alps, and two, we could go for a leekski and grab something to eat. But we didn't have much time, as we were way behind schedule. It was almost 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we still had 550 kilometers, 345 miles, to go to make the 10:45 p.m. deadline. I called Johnny and told him we were still so far away from Madrid that we might not make our flight on time.
"What do you mean? We have day rooms for you."
I told him he might want to think about changing the day rooms to night rooms, and he said the rooms weren't available at night. As a matter of fact, all the rooms in the city had been booked by standard travelers. It was Cape Girardeau all over again, meaning if we didn't make it out of Madrid by 10:45 p.m., we'd be stranded as well. I ran into the rest stop to drain the main vein, the all-time worst slang ever for going pee, and get something quick to eat. I settled on a little apple pie in a box, some blue gum to get rid of the horrible aftertaste of the dark beer, and a baguette. I bit into it and found out the hard way that it was more fun to say baguette than it was to actually eat a baguette. It was like chowing down on an overcooked rock. The little apple pie in a box wasn't much better. It tasted like a little apple box in a box and left a worse aftertaste than the dark beer. We scrambled back on the GRCS and flew down the highway at the light speed of 70 kilometers, 45 miles an hour, trying desperately to make up some of the time we'd lost in the Alps. It turned out that one of the drivers spoke Spanish, so Ray Ray could communicate with him. The driver told him we were lucky to still be moving, for the engine had almost overheated in the mountains and broken down. At that point, my back was so sore from hours of being confined on the Iron Maiden bench, I was starting to wish we had broken down and cannibalized each other. I kept Johnny in the loop about the progress we were making, and he kept me in the loop about how the raw crew were still stuck in Belfast, stranded in a 5-star hotel surrounded by bars and restaurants. I belched up an acidic cocktail of dark beer and box pie and told him to tell the raw crew to go fuck themselves. He was relieved I'd been giving him constant updates, as he'd been trying in vain for hours to get a hold of Ricky Steamboat, our producer, and the guy who was supposed to be in charge of this band of gypsies. I told Ricky that the office had been trying to contact him but couldn't get through to his phone, and he said nonchalantly, "Well, that's because I turned off my phone to save the battery in case of emergency."
"What? Well, this is an emergency."
Steamboat took action at that point, doling out gems of advice like telling Ray to speak that language the drivers understand, Spanish, and find out how much farther we have to go. Or warning us, "Guys, there will be no more stops and we probably won't be able to check into the day rooms," at 8:30 p.m. with 75 kilometers to go. Finally, after almost 24 hours of travel, we saw the signs for the Madrid airport, and there was no time to waste since it was already a few minutes before 10 p.m. We'd have to grab our bags and run straight onto the plane, or we'd be stuck in Madrid with no hotel for who knows how long. Maybe I could sleep under another conference room table. The lights of the airport shone bright as we all gave a cheer of delight, and then drove right past it. The driver had assumed he was going to the departure terminal, but took a wrong turn. And you know how the old saying goes, to assume is to make an ass out of you and me. And I'm gonna fucking rip the heads off these jack-off drivers if I miss this flight. Or something like that. By the time the driver wove his way back to the main road, we'd lost another 15 minutes, and it was 10:20 p.m. when we finally pulled into the departure area of the airport. Steamboat was yelling for us to get off the bus, file into a line and pass our luggage from person to person like they were sandbags and we were trying to save the village from a flood. To his credit, it was a pretty efficient idea and we got our bags off in minutes. Then we made a mad dash across the airport, sprinting down the concourse like a gang of jacked-up O.J. Simpsons in a 70s Hertz commercial. Dated reference. But instead of jumping over luggage carts, we were jumping over sleeping people. The floor of the airport was covered with so many bodies it looked like the Black Death Plague in 1665 London. Really dated reference. Security knew we were coming, and since it was a charter flight, pretty much breezed us through customs at 10:32 p.m. They probably figured the risk of one of us blowing up the plane was worth it, as long as it cleared up space in the airport. We darted to our gate and piled onto the plane like soldiers jumping onto a helicopter to escape Hamburger Hill in 1969. The pilot told us we didn't have much time and to find a seat immediately, so I ran to the back of the plane and strapped myself in. Some of the crew were still stowing their bags as the door closed, and we taxied over to the runway faster than any other boy has ever gone. We booked down the tarmac screaming into flight, and I felt like Indiana Jones taking off in the biplane as the Incas threw their spears. As the wheels lifted off, I looked at my phone and saw the time, 10:44 p.m. We'd made it by the skin of our collective chinny-chin-chins. I reached down between my legs, eased the seat back, and breathed a sigh of relief. Minutes later, I was wolfing down an airplane chicken breast and an airplane chunk of beef. I'd asked for both, and it was one of the best meals of my life. I asked the stewardess for a Miller Lite to wash it down, and she replied,
"I'm sorry, sir. We only have dark beer."
I threw up in my mouth and asked for a straight vodka. Chapter 30. Play More Songs. In the fall of 2008, I called Rich Ward and asked him if the time was right to fire up Fozzie again. After the All That Remains tour in the winter of 06, we'd gone our separate ways and hadn't done anything together since. In the spring of 08, there'd been a reissue of ATR called All That Remains Reloaded, which included a bonus DVD of our 2005 Download Festival performance. When I watched, it reminded me how powerful a live band we were, and I wondered why we'd been inactive for so long. Fozzie had gained a lot of momentum from All That Remains, and the song Enemy had been our biggest hit ever, getting plays on over 60 stations across North America. But Rich and I got busy with other projects, and Fozzie ended up on hiatus. The two of us missed playing together and decided it was time to get back to where we once belonged and write some new music. But it had been 4 years, and our momentum had pretty much ground to a halt. All we had going for us at that point were a few good records under our belt and our fans' loyalty, but other than that, we were starting pretty much from scratch. Rich and I believed we had the chemistry and the X factor, I ain't talking about Blaze Bailey, to be something special. After a long talk, we decided we were up for the challenge of taking Fozzie to the next level, but there would have to be a few changes made to the way we approached the band. If we were going to do it, we were going to do it all the way. We decided there would be no more part-time efforts, no more half-assing, no more taking the band lightly. It was time to go hard or go home, so we made a new set of Fozzie fundamentals. First off, Fozzie would now be our number one priority. That wasn't too hard a commitment for me to make as I was approaching 40 and contemplating life after wrestling. I'd been playing in bands since I was 12 years old, and my two goals as a kid were to be a wrestler and to be in a band, and I was lucky enough to be doing both. My drive to get to the next level with Fozzie was immeasurable, and after climbing to the top of the wrestling world, I knew I could do it again in rock and roll, but only if I approached it with total dedication. Second, we needed a serious image makeover. Just take a look at our video for Enemy if you want evidence of our previous fashion faux pas. I was wearing gray cords, seriously, cords, and a frumpy black long-sleeve shirt. Rich wore a cowboy hat. Drummer Frank Fonseer wore camo pants with an orange shirt and a toque. "I've got an amazing outfit for the video," he had boasted proudly a few days before. And bassist Sean Delson wore a stitched Western long sleeve and baggy Levi's with a wristwatch. We looked Bush League terrible, which really surprises me in retrospect. I'd always been very conscious of my image in wrestling and in the early days of Fozzie, so I don't know why I allowed us to go grunge with All That Remains. Maybe we had focused so much on the gimmick of Fozzie in the early days of the band that we felt we needed to binge and purge ourselves of any type of style or fashion for a while? Whatever the reason, it was a bad decision, as people listened to music with their eyes as well as their ears. And if we were sounding like Black Sabbath and looking like Revenge of the Nerds, we weren't going to get far. But those days were done, and we were ready for an extreme rock and roll makeover. Third, we needed to solidify our lineup and stick to it. Because of our sporadic tours and lengthy bouts of inactivity in the past, the band was basically just a revolving door of musicians, with Rich and me being the only constants. But with our new attitude, we intended to be working a fuller schedule and wanted to put together the best lineup in Fozzy history. The first order of business was to bring back Frank, the best drummer we'd ever played with and the perfect complement for Rich's heavy groove riffs. He'd been asked to leave the band in 2005, but we were ready for him to come back. However, when he showed up, he looked less like a rock star and more like Bubba Ray Dudley, circa 1999. He'd gained a lot of weight, shaved his head, and grown a scruffy beard. But when we read him the New Image Riot Act, he promised to update his look and get in better shape, which he did. So we gave him the benefit of the doubt and signed him up. Sean Delson seemed like he was into the new way of doing things, but our second guitar player, Mike Martin, didn't really show much enthusiasm for our plans, and we parted ways. We needed to find a replacement for Mike, but that could wait because the most important part of the new and improved Fozzy had to be the songs. I'd been compiling ideas for a few years already, and Rich was pleasantly surprised when I sent him 14 full songs of lyrics a few days after we reunited. I write my lyrics starting with song titles and work backward from there. So when I come across an interesting phrase or sentence in a book, I write it down. Then when my muse visits, I scan through the list and find one that inspires me. There was Martyr No More, I love the title, Para Skeva Decatriophobia, The Fear of Friday the 13th, and the best song title Steve Harris never wrote, Pray for Blood, my old friend Dr. Luther's catchphrase when he worked in Japan, which I turned into a tale about 10th century Vikings. God Pounds His Nails, lifted from Stephen King's The Talisman. And Broken Soul, I envisioned it as a thrash song, but Rich had a different idea and it became our first ballad. The standard way songs are written is to write the music first and lyrics second. But in typical Fozzy fashion, we did things our own way. Rich used my words to inspire him to create new songs or rework them into the riffs and melodies he'd already written. After a few months of shaping and reshaping, we decided on the 12 songs that would make up our new record, Chasing the Grail. We began recording the album while our manager, Mark Willis, searched for a new record deal. All That Remains had been independently released on my own label, Ash Records, and even though it had sold fairly well, we still lost money when our distribution company went bankrupt, leaving me personally in the hole for about $75,000, so we needed a new home. Unfortunately, our name value was pretty much non-existent after lying dormant for 4 years, so our options were fairly limited. It was good news when our old friend John Howarth, of Boots fame, came aboard and signed us to his Australian-based label Riot Records, making us their first worldwide release. A few months later, we wrapped up the recording and prepared for the release date. We knew the record was amazing, but were a little worried. Would anybody care about a new Fozzy album? Turns out people did. Chasing the Grail debuted at number 6 on the Billboard Heatseekers chart, which was the first time we'd ever been on a Billboard chart of any kind. We just missed being on the actual Billboard 200 by only a few hundred units, which pissed me off because if I'd known, I would have bought the damn extra 253 copies myself. With the record out, it was time to bring in a new guitar player, and we had a private audition with only 2 candidates. Both guys were great guitar players, but as soon as I saw Billy Gray, I knew we had our man. Billy had played in Fozzy years earlier, and I'd always liked him. And when he walked into the studio with his multicolored faux hawk, chain wallet, and chucks, I saw he had the perfect look for the new Image Fozzy. Our new lineup complete, it was time to get back on the road, and we booked our first gig in almost 3 years at B.B. King's in New York City. Our return gig was the place to be in NYC that night as we played in front of an all-star cast, including my wife, Jessica, Bumblefoot from Guns N' Roses, Steve Brown from Trickster, Eddie Trunk and Don Jameson from That Metal Show, Ripper Owens from Judas Priest, and Richard Christie from The Howard Stern Show. Vinnie Paul came on stage halfway through the concert to present us with a tray of Jack Daniel's shots to celebrate our new album's release. And our old friend Mike Portnoy jammed on Judas Priest's Free Will Burning with us. He was in town with his new bandmates from Avenged Sevenfold, and all 5 of them showed up together. I'd been an Avenged fan for years, and it was fruit to see them at our gig, and I was impressed with their bond of brotherhood. It seemed that they went everywhere together like an actual gang, which was something I wanted Fozzie to be. Charlie Benanti and Frank Bello from Anthrax were also there, and they brought their former singer, Joey Belladonna, to the show. They'd been considering bringing him back into the band and wanted to see how they got along and what the vibes were like in a social situation. They stayed for the whole gig, and a few days later, Charlie told me Joey had rejoined Anthrax. So Fozzie is taking credit for being the heavy metal cupid that brought Anthrax back together with their long-estranged singer, due to our soothing sounds. Now if we can only get Slash and